Hello everyone, hopefully you can hear me at the back, and thank you all very much for coming. So as some of you are probably aware, half of the Nobel Prize in Physics last year was awarded for the discovery of exoplanets, and this was done by two scientists, including Didier, who's at Cambridge. But I'm going to be talking about what the other half of the Nobel Prize was awarded for. It was awarded to Jim Keeble, pictured here, for the work he'd done over his career establishing the foundations of what's known as now modern physical cosmology. So what is physical cosmology all about? Really, it's an attempt to answer some of the biggest questions that you get when you stare up at the night, at the sky at night, including how big is the universe? What is in the universe? How does it change over time? Where did it all come from? And potentially, how will it all end? And so these are the sort of big questions that we would like to answer in our study of physical cosmology. So how do we go about studying the universe? Well, as a scientist, mostly what you'd like to do is go into your lab and run an experiment in your lab to test the properties of the universe and to understand how it works. However, it's obviously quite difficult to get all of the universe in a lab to study it. Or to create a universe in a lab would probably be a very dangerous thing to do. So instead, all we can do is observe the night sky and look at the properties that we see there. In that sense, cosmologists are a little like paleontologists. So there, at least stereotypically, a paleontologist would find a fossil and he'd look about where the fossil was found and the structure of the fossil to infer things about what was going on there. And perhaps in this case, he might infer something about the properties of dinosaurs, when they lived, what they ate, and how big they were. And so this is kind of what we want to do in cosmology, is by using fossils that we find in our observation, infer things about the general properties of the universe. So what are the kind of fossils that we observe in cosmology? Well, there are a range of different ones, but I'm going to focus on two of them today. One of them is signals in the oldest light in the universe, which is known as the cosmic microwave background. And the other ones are signals that are hidden in the distribution of galaxies, which is embodied in this little pretty picture here. And I'll dig into both of these in a little more detail, starting with the cosmic microwave background. So to put the picture in the story of the cosmic microwave background, it helps to go back about 60 years and to see what the ideas were floating around then. At that point in time, there were two general ideas of how the universe existed. The first one is known as the Big Bang cosmology, in which the universe began in a very hot and dense state and expanded and cooled over time, eventually coming to a state like the state we observe at the moment. The other main idea was something known as the steady state cosmology, and in this cosmology, the universe wasn't really changing. If you could travel in space and time and go to any different point in the history or the future of the universe, what you'd find is a universe that looks roughly similar. There'd be galaxies like our own, stars like our own, and all those sorts of processes going on for eternity in all directions of space and time. And so people weren't really sure which of these ideas was correct, and there were proponents of both looking for evidence to try and decide whether it was a Big Bang cosmology or a steady state cosmology. And in particular, there was a group looking a group at Princeton, led by Bob Dickey over here, that were trying to look at what would be the consequences of the Big Bang model if it's what actually happened in our universe. What are the theoretical ideas that would lead to signatures that we could search for this? And so Jim Peebles, pictured here, was thinking about the theoretical implications of a Big Bang universe, while the rest of the group was setting out to look and measure, using equipment like this, potentially signals from a Big Bang universe. So what kind of things would they be looking for? Well, that we have to think about how the universe changes in a Big Bang universe. As I said at the beginning, it would have begun potentially in a very hot and dense state. So this is 1 second after the creation of the universe. It would be incredibly hot, billions of times hotter than anything that we have on Earth today. But as it aged over time, in hundreds of seconds to years and to billions of years, it would have cooled from this very hot state to a very cold state. This is around 3 Kelvin, which is around minus 270 degrees Celsius. Which would make our winter feel very warm, actually. But there were lots of different changes that happened during the history of this universe, including about 5 billion years ago the sun would have been born, about 14 billion years ago the first galaxies would have come into existence. Before this, there would have been basically no stars or galaxies in the universe. But actually, what I'm going to focus on is what happened when the universe was actually around 400,000 years old. Here it underwent a really fundamental difference and change. Before this state, it was so hot and dense that matter as we know it, the atoms that make up everything, including the chairs that you're sitting on, couldn't be formed. They would be broken apart. And instead, what would happen is the universe would exist in this sort of soup-like state with everything floating around all together, unbound together, smashing into each other all the time. After this transition, however, the universe had cooled just enough so that atoms could form, and then you'd start to get the types of matter that we're familiar with, particularly gases forming. And this was a very important transition in the universe, particularly when it comes to light. I'll start with this by an analogy with something much closer to home, which is the physics that happens in our sun. So some of you might be aware that it takes about 8 minutes for light to propagate from the sun to the Earth, and that's because light travels at a finite speed, and the Earth is actually quite far away from the sun, so it takes a whole 8 minutes. But light is actually really, the energy in the sun is released in the center, and so you can think about light being generated in the center of the sun and propagating it out. And unfortunately, the sun is so hot and dense, and ionized, it's sort of like a soup that I mentioned how the early universe was, that light can't propagate in a straight line out to us as it would like, and instead it bashes around sort of like a ball in a pinball machine, making this really jagged. And in fact, it takes 10,000 years roughly for a photon, for light generated at the center of the sun to reach the surface, and then it only takes 8 minutes to go from the surface to us. So we think actually a very similar thing happened in the Big Bang model. A very similar thing would have happened in our universe, where at the beginning, in this hot plasma, light wouldn't have been able to travel, and it scattered around like a ping pong ball, moving around in directions like this. And then when this transition occurred, the light was no longer coupled to the matter, and it could propagate through, and so the light, which would have been generated in this early phase, would be just propagating through the universe, streaming through, filling the universe in every direction and every space and time with this relic radiation that was left over. And so this was one thing that people could go out and look for. And so in the early 60s, this Princeton group was starting to build an experiment to look at this. But unfortunately, it didn't work out that they discovered it, as just 60 miles away, two other scientists, Robert Wilson and Arno Penzias, they were working for a telecoms company called Bell Labs, and they were developing the technology that now fuels everyone's mobile phones, how to communicate using microwaves. And they were looking at this big instrument that they have here in the background, and they were finding something very peculiar, which is wherever they pointed their telescope in the sky, they'd have some noise that they didn't understand where it was coming from. And quite famously, they spent a lot of time looking into their instrument to try and understand where this noise was coming from, because they just didn't understand it. So they took apart their instrument. Quite famously, they had some birds nesting inside of this tent, inside of this feed horn here, and so they went in and chased them out and then cleaned up after all the birds. But still, they couldn't find where this noise was coming from. Quite fortunately for them, one of their friends was actually a friend of the research group at Princeton, and realized that the ideas might be related and put them in touch. And indeed, it turned out that the radiation that they were seeing in their detector was this relic radiation that had been produced early in the universe that the Princeton group were looking for, this cosmic microwave background radiation. And so this radiation has been studied since its discovery in 1964, including in the early 90s, there was a satellite mission that was launched to study its properties in detail, and found out that indeed, this radiation did look very similar all over in the sky, and this really helped confirm our understanding that we live in a Big Bang-type universe. However, there's a lot more, actually, that we learned having discovered this radiation. The first thing is actually something quite interesting, which is in the Big Bang model, when this universe was cooling, it describes a method how all the sort of light elements in the universe are generated. So the light elements are things like hydrogen or helium. And within this Big Bang model picture, Jim Peebles and others calculated how much of these elements should be produced as a function, depending on how much total matter there is in the universe. So he calculated these curvy lines that you see here, the blue, the green, the red, and the pink. And then more recently, we've been able to measure both how much total matter there is in the universe, which is given by this gray line, as well as looking in the universe around us to seeing and counting and measuring how much of these elements there are. And that comes across with these horizontal lines here. And what you see is that all of these lines seem to cross where the two measurements, the two horizontal, the horizontal and the vertical line, meet. They cross where the theory line predicts them. And so this is another a really interesting consequence, which is from this Big Bang model, you can predict how much of these elements there should be in the universe. I should say that this only describes how light elements, things like the low gases and lithium, are formed. Really heavy elements, things like iron and gold, are formed in a very different manner. They're formed in explosions of stars, which I won't have time to talk about today. But it's very interesting and has been in the news in the last year. So I said that this radiation was the same in all directions. However, as we studied it with increasing detail, what we found out is that there were very small fluctuations. So when we were able to measure with incredibly high precision, first in the 90s and in increasing precision over time, we found that there are fluctuations in this radiation on the skies of one part in 10,000. So incredibly small, but fluctuations are there nonetheless. And what we have now is, what I'm showing now is the latest measurements of these tiny fluctuations. And this was a result produced 2 years ago by a European satellite that had measured these across the sky. And you can see all of these sorts of fluctuations that sort of look like noise. And these are actually the fossils I was mentioning earlier. These contain a lot of information about the processes that shape the universe. So let's delve a little into them. First of all, thinking about where these fluctuations came from. So to begin thinking about this, I want to think about what happens when you drop a pebble into a pond. What happens, as you see here, is that you get these waves that are generated, and they move out in a circle from their origin, like this. But what happens if instead of just dropping one pebble in the pond, I drop many pebbles simultaneously? Each one of them has a wave that propagates out in a circle, but then it interferes with all of the other waves there to produce this horribly complicated surface. And we think this is the kind of picture that happened. We think at the very early part of the universe, something generated waves, small waves in the universe. And that generated, these waves propagated out and all mixed with each other, creating a surface that looks like this, with areas being more matter or less matter. Very small fluctuations, as I said, one part in 10 to the 4, but small fluctuations nonetheless that arose from the interference of these different sound waves. And then when we measure the cosmic microwave background, what we see is the imprints of these small fluctuations from these waves that have interfered. And this is where we think the origin of these fluctuations comes from. So with this picture of them as waves propagating from the beginning and interfering, we can think about how we can use this to learn about the universe. And one thing we can do is thinking about what happens if I drop a pebble into a pool of treacle instead of a pool of water. Clearly, the way these waves are going to propagate out is going to be very different, because the treacle will basically stop the wave from propagating. And that's demonstrated in a schematic way here, where you have two different substances with the waves propagating. You can see one of them, the wave lasts a lot longer than the other. So this is the sort of ways that we can use these fossils to learn about the universe. By studying how the waves propagated, we can infer things about the universe. So this is something that people have been doing recently. And to do that, you need a way of systematically studying these fluctuations. And we do that by essentially measuring how points at the different at the ends of different length rulers, denoted here by these long lines, are correlated. You can imagine if you lay down a ruler that's the same length as the waves, so going from one crest to another, you'd expect to find more matter at the ends of the stick. Whereas if it's at an area where the wave isn't peaking, you'd expect to find less. And this can be summarized in this plot here, which is known as a power spectrum, and it measures how correlated points are at the ends of different sized rulers. So on this side of the plot, you have large rulers, these stretching across the entire sky, moving to smaller and smaller scales. And what you see here is this peak here at a certain scale. And this peak corresponds to the peak of these waves that were propagating in the early universe. And then you have a trough, which corresponds not to you no longer being at the right scale of these waves. So this is a systematic way in which we can probe the properties of these waves that were propagating in the early universe. As I said before, if the material in the universe is different, the waves will propagate in a different manner. And that will have its effect on this power spectrum. So as I said, this measures how points at the ends of different size rulers are correlated. And what I'm doing here is we're changing the structure of the universe, changing the amount of matter that's in the universe. And you can see that this has a visible effect on the correlations at the edges of these rulers, changing the structure. And so by measuring this line, we're able to work out what, for example, how much matter there was in the universe at that time. However, these fluctuations actually tell us even more useful than that. So I said that they were very small in the cosmic microwave background, that they're one part in 10 to the 4, one part in 10,000. However, that means there are small areas in the universe that had a bit more matter than others, and some had a bit less. And then gravity went to work, and over time, these slowly collapsed, and they slowly grew from being a very tiny fluctuation to getting bigger. And this is an example showing a simulation how those tiny fluctuations in the beginning evolve over time. And what you see is there are regions of the universe which become empty, these blue areas, and regions that become very dense, these red and white hot regions. And in these white hot regions, the density is no longer a really tiny fluctuation, but a massive one. And it's at these points in the universe where actually galaxies and stars would start to form. So we on Earth would live in a galaxy that would exist in one of these bright white hot regions. So these tiny fluctuations that we saw at the beginning, these seeds, are actually the seeds that lead to all the galaxies and structures that we see in the universe around us. So we can go out and look at the properties of how galaxies are distributed in the universe. This is some measurements where people have looked out from the Earth, looking further and further away, and noting where galaxies are distributed in the sky. In this case, just a slice of an angle through the sky. And what you see is you end up with this knotted pattern, quite similar to what we saw in simulation before, with some regions we're having lots and lots of galaxies, and some regions being very empty. So this is nice that those things sort of agree, but there's actually something even more we can do. As these galaxies seem to evolve from the structures that we saw, these small fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, they probably contain a lot of the fossil information that we had in the cosmic microwave background earlier. So the question is whether you can trace sort of features that should exist in these sound wave fluctuations that we said existed in the early universe into their properties and how they impacted the distribution of galaxies. So we think there is a connection between the two, and hopefully I'm going to walk you through it in this sort of quite complicated plot. At the moment, we should just focus on the blue line and the red line. As I said, in the early universe, we had a sound wave that propagated out, and that's shown here by the green and the blue waves moving out. This is sort of a cross-section through the wave as it propagates out away from the origin. However, when we reach this special point in time where the universe changes from being the soup to being like atoms, the photons and the gas will no longer become coupled, and they'll separate away. The result of this is that the photons, the red lines, continue to move out, but the matter, the gas, shown here in blue, no longer moves. It stops. It's frozen at the distance it had moved in this early universe phase. Then what happens is over time, gravity occurs and the distribution of the gas changes, particularly it grows in this region. But the key thing to focus on is that you end up with this little bump, which is the relic of where this wave propagated. And this little bump will actually mean that if we look in our universe, we should find an excess of galaxies separated by the distance that this wave had propagated. And so we can go out and look for this in the distributions of galaxies I showed earlier. We can look in these types of plots, in these data, to see whether there are sort of circle-like features which have the shape of these waves that have propagated through the universe. And this is exemplified in this sort of artistic image, which might be a little hard to see on the projector, but you see that there are circles of waves, and this is how far the sound wave had propagated in the beginning before this transition occurred, and you see that there's an excess of galaxies. This is exaggerated for artistic effect, but we can look for this in data, and this is a plot showing this excess bump that we find in data. So really, in the distribution of galaxies, we have the same fossil signature that we saw in the very early universe. And so with this, we can bring it back to the beginning questions I posed at the beginning that we were trying to answer. Questions like, how big is the universe? What is in it? Can we now answer these using some of the tools we've seen today? And the answer is yes, we can answer some of these. So first of all, we know now roughly how big the universe is. It's 88 with 25 zeros after it, which is a mind-bogglingly big number, no matter how many times I write it down. In fact, it's so big that it doesn't make sense to me. If I wrote it down with 3 zeros missing, I would still think it looked about the same number. So what you can see here is a set of different scales showing how the scale of the universe here compares to different things, with these steps on the ladders being increases by a factor of 10. So going from from the size of us to the size of the Earth is roughly 7 steps up this ladder. It's roughly 10 million times bigger. And you can keep following this up over the things that we know, from the planets to the solar system to our galaxy, and it's even bigger. It's just a mind-bogglingly big number. But we also know more about this. From the way that waves propagate in the early universe, we can work out what is the contents of the universe at that time. And in fact, what we find out is that the ordinary matter, everything that we know about us on Earth, actually only contributes to a very small percentage of all of the matter in the universe, only about 5%. The rest of the universe is made up of two different things, one thing called dark matter and the other called dark energy, which I unfortunately don't have time to talk about today, but it is quite mysterious things that we still need to fully understand. And then finally, all of this work has brought together this sort of general picture that we have lots of evidence to believe in of the way that the universe has evolved over time. We think it began in this hot Big Bang state, cooling and cooling, eventually generating this radiation with small fluctuations. Over time, these small fluctuations grew and grew and grew until eventually they collapsed to form stars and to form galaxies. And then eventually we end up with where we are now, which is observing galaxies around us. And this is 13.8 billion years after the beginning. And so with that, I'd like to conclude and thank you all for your attention.